Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to talk college hockey. This is USCHO Live from U.S. College Hockey Online at uscho.com. USCHO Live is brought to you by the USCHO Fan Shop at shop.uscho.com. For college hockey and college sports fan gear, visit shop.uscho.com. Be a part of the conversation. Give us a call now or message us on Twitter at USCHO. This is USCHO Live.
Good evening and welcome to USCHO Live from USCHO.com. I'm Ed Trefsker along with Jim Connolly. Good evening, Jim.
Good evening, Ed. Good to be with you at the best time of year. Playoff hockey is really, truly here now.
And the snow is even melting.
It's starting to. You know, somebody asked me, they said, you've had some warm temperatures there. How's your snow doing? I looked out and I said, hey, it's not bad. It's down to 2 feet.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's almost golf season.
Well, before we get into tonight's program, a reminder, don't get left out in the cold this spring. Be there as the best of the best will compete for the title of national champion. Experience the NCAA Men's Frozen Four. Regional action drops the puck March 27th through 29 and continues April 9th and 11th at the Frozen Four in Boston. Experience it live as determination will make history. Visit ncaa.com/frozen4 to make a date with champions. Talking about determination making history, both our guests tonight, Niagara coach Dave Burkholder and Notre Dame radio play-by-play guy Darren Pritchett, were both witnesses and in Dave's case a coaching participant in some long series this weekend where the winning team ended up losing in overtime but prevailed in the series. It'll be interesting to get their perspectives on both of that. So I guess that's a bit of a theme for tonight.
Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't just losing in overtime for either one of those teams. It was losing heartbreaking overtime games for Niagara. It was a game two where they already had a 1-0 lead, and they lost in triple overtime. I believe it was the 8th longest game in college hockey history. And, of course, anybody that's a college hockey fan, unless you've been under a rock for a week, you know that Notre Dame lost the first game of their series to UMass in 5 overtimes, the longest game in Division I history, with a goaltender who finished the game with 87 saves. I think for either team, even to get up and play the next day's game is amazing. But for Notre Dame, knowing that its backs were against the wall, to come back, come from behind, and win a tight game on Saturday night, game two, and then a convincing 7-0 victory to close things out and get a shutout. You know, this goaltender just set the Division I record for saves in a game, Cal Peterson with 87 on Friday night. He didn't post a shutout in the last night. He posted a shutout somewhere in between that in-game shutout where he went about 5 periods without giving up a goal, 5.5 periods. So remarkable hockey. That just kind of was part of the games that set the pace and the series that set the pace this weekend. But we saw some really good hockey across the 3 leagues that got going in the playoffs. And now this weekend we'll have 2 more leagues that get going. They finish their regular seasons, and then the good old Big Ten pulling up the rear, they still have more regular season hockey to play.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned in a blog post at uscho.com that the long overtimes are reflecting a lack of offense in college hockey, and it's interesting. We've seen that over the years. We've seen a few things. We've seen save percentages go up like crazy as goalies get better equipment and better training and technique and so forth. And also the defensive style of the game has changed. I've seen games this year where teams will put out a defense against a top line for another team that really resembles a penalty kill defense and just packing it in really tight and just blocking lanes. So there are a number of things that seem to have changed. What's your take on what's causing this?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any secret that offense is significantly down in this game. From the 70s to the 90s, I think it went down, and then really from the 90s to today, it went down significantly. So over a 40-year span, it's really, really reduced. I go back and, you know, some of the historical things we see, old ECAC championship scores, old beanpot scores out here, and seeing 14 to 5 games, those weren't that rare. We don't see 14 goals in a game that often. We, you know, Air Force put up a 10 spot last week. That's a real aberration. Not too many teams get to double digits anymore. But the 8-7 games that were commonplace, don't forget Boston University and Northern Michigan played a national title game with a final score of 8-7. So those games just don't happen anymore, and these long overtime games never seem to result. And the research I did this week, 38 of the 50 games that are now in the top 50 longest games, and to be in the top 50 longest games, the game just, it can't go to overtime or double overtime. It actually has to be 8 minutes and 14 seconds into the second overtime. It used to be a while ago that if you just got to double overtime, you made that top 50 list, but we've just had so many games. 38 of the 50 games have happened since 2000. And there's been some seasons that have had multiples. And, you know, obviously last Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights, or Friday and Saturday nights, we had three of those happen in the span of less than 48 hours, which is really remarkable. So I think that the offense, there's a lot that goes into it. Offensive players are talented, but the defensive systems, as you mentioned, I do think goaltending equipment maybe has gotten a little bit out of hand, but goaltending training has gone up significantly. And just the ability for teams to know how to keep their opponent on the perimeter and make the game easier mm-hmm. for a goaltender. I didn't get to watch that game on Friday night between UMass and Notre Dame, but I know the system that each of those two teams plays. And it's really about, we'll give up shots, but they're going to be shots that our goaltender can save. Now, I'm pretty positive that both goaltenders, Steve Maslow's for UMass and Cal Peterson for Notre Dame, had some unbelievable saves in the overtime. You heard them as the radio guys were calling them, and you know that they were gems and stuff that might have gone in. But for the most part of those 87 saves, and we'll get to hear from Darren Pritchett and his opinion, but you got to believe that a lot of those came from areas that he was comfortable making the save. And that seems to be a difference in the way that offense generates itself than it did back in the 90s and back in the 80s and back in the 70s. I mean, there was a lot of just goal mouth passes that were, you know, for a golf term, a 2-foot putt or a 1-foot putt, mm-hmm. a tap in. They were easier. The goals were a lot easier to come by, and rebounds used to sit there a lot more. That doesn't happen as much anymore. So when I wrote that piece this week, I wasn't actually complaining, and I've gotten some kind of terse feedback through Twitter and whatnot of people that say, "Well, you don't appreciate good hockey." No, I absolutely appreciate it, but I think that this is what I was just trying to say, is that it is a sign that offense really is still missing from this game. No matter what you try to do with rules, no matter what you try to do to put more offense in the game, it's still almost impossible to do. And these triple and quadruple and quintuple overtime games are kind of a signal of that.
Well, you mentioned rules, and I was going to bring that up. The NCAA Rules Committee has done a number of things in an attempt to increase scoring, and perhaps it would be even lower if it wasn't for it. I mean, we can go back through some of them. Hybrid icing is part of it. Emphasis against obstruction a few years ago, which I think, in my humble opinion, has completely gone by the wayside, and clutch and grab has come back in a big way. But things like face-off staying in the offensive zone when the puck goes out of play, getting rid of the hand pass in all zones, allowing a team to score or to have a power play if it scores on a delayed penalty, all those things were designed to increase scoring, but either it hasn't worked or it would be a lot worse without them.
Yeah, you know what, there was a head coach in Hockey East that I worked under, Bruce Crowder. He was at Lowell and Northeastern and spent some time at Maine under Sean Walsh. He had a philosophy in terms of putting the puck in the net. He used to say that as long as you don't pick it up with your glove and throw it in, it should be a goal. He was all for kicking. He was high-sticking above your shoulder. He didn't care. He really didn't care. He said the goals were so darn hard to score that however you had to get the puck in, as long as you literally didn't, you know, basically turn it into a game of basketball or team handball, you were okay with putting the puck in the net. And you do feel like the NCAA has tried to kind of, you know, go in that way. You know, kicking is not allowed. You can't actually kick the puck in, but you can turn your skate. You can stop into the puck. You just can't actually make a direct kicking motion. So they've tried to do their best at finding a way to create offense, but it still doesn't work. I just think that there's too many ways to work your systems and to pack it in and to, you know, I've seen teams in the last few weeks that, you know, throw three guys across that red line and really a 1-3-1-4 check, and you know, the only way that they're going to try to score is if they make a team make a mistake or they get an offensive zone draw off of an icing. But they're so committed to defense first that it makes goal scoring very hard to come by. I don't think that's an exciting brand of hockey for fans to watch. Don't know that that was the case in any of the games this weekend that went to double or triple or in the case of Notre Dame, UMass, five overtimes. But I'm also not believing that there was no defense first system in the neutral zone in any of those games. I think that that was probably the case in every one of them. So, you know, it's something that the game has tried to address. I just don't think it's you're able to these days. It's too easy for a coach to develop a system that you can win playing defense and then being opportunistic on offense.
You know, if you're talking about an overtime game like that, a multiple overtime game in what's a best of three series, both teams are having to put up with the same issues. It doesn't affect things that badly. However, if that were to happen in any of the conference playoffs coming up, the final six matching up in the Big Ten in a couple of weeks, or the final four in the other leagues, or in the NCAAs in a first game in a regional or in a semifinal in the Frozen Four, that ends up being a huge disadvantage for the team that has to play in it compared to the one that doesn't. And I don't know if there's anything you can do about it, but if scoring is that difficult, you're going to have those kind of situations possibly come up.
The only thing you can do about it is the disgusting solution of the shootout, which the International Ice Hockey Federation uses. It disgusts me to watch it. And, you know,
yeah, me too.
I'll admit that when the U.S. played Russia a couple of years ago in the Olympics, I thought that that game that they beat them in a shootout was extremely exciting, but I hated that way as a way to decide a game. It's just not the way it's supposed to happen. It's not it's not a natural occurrence in hockey. I don't mind in the regular season in the NHL just to, you know, make the standings a little bit more interesting, but it's certainly does not belong in tournament hockey. And so I really don't think there is a solution. If you're in a game that goes five overtimes, you better just hope that you're really well conditioned and you can come back after playing two and a half games one night and play another game, maybe a game and a little bit more the next night against a team that conceivably is better rested. So
What about the compromise they've tried out in the American Hockey League this year, going 4-on-4 then 3-on-3?
I think it's fine in the regular season, but I don't think that you should take a form of hockey that is anything but what hockey is meant to be played as, which is a game of 5-on-5 with a goaltender on each side, and then just let the teams decide it that way. It's worked in the Stanley Cup playoffs for a very long time, and again, you're talking about a situation like a best of three, like we talk about, where both teams are affected by it and they both get the same rest. I don't think a single elimination should really change it that much. I do like that concept of 4-on-4 and 3-on-3, but throw that in the regular season. Don't put that into championships that I care about, that these teams care about.
Yeah, I'm definitely in agreement with you on that, and that's a good reason for a Thursday-Saturday gap in the Frozen Four.
Oh, well, absolutely, and I wish they could actually do that at the regional level. That's something that I've been a proponent for since they've gone to 16 teams, is put both of the regionals in the same geographic site, have
one regional play Thursday, Saturday, and have the other region play Friday, Sunday. There's no reason that they can't do that, except that they just really want to hit more than two markets every year at the regional time. But if they were to do that solution that I just talked about, where it becomes almost like a super regional, very similar to how basketball operates in the first and second rounds, I think that you could really eliminate a lot of problems that have to do with multiple overtime games and rest.
I think you're onto something there, Jim. I'm with you on that. That makes a lot of sense. Turning to some other things, we're getting toward the time of year where teams start to wrap up their season when they're eliminated from the postseason. And what is the first of what may be many, many, as we see most years, Devin Shore leaving a year early to sign with Dallas, leaving Maine as they were eliminated.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's surprised in the way that we've talked it here before, the way that the collective bargaining agreement is written. For drafted players, that's a great advantage for the player and for the team to get them out after their junior year so that the team doesn't have the ability to lose that player to free agency the following year. And for undrafted players, it's even more of an advantage if you leave, say, after your sophomore year. If you're 21 years old or 22 years old, some of these sophomores, you've played and you're an undrafted free agent. You have a lot of offers out there, for one thing, and most of those teams would love to get a look at you. So you go in and play one game in the NHL at the end of this season. That counts as your first year on your entry-level contract, and all you have is two more years before you can make the big money. Players obviously want to make the big money, but players' agents want those players to make the big money because as an agent, you've probably been scouting this kid since he was 14, maybe 16, maybe 18, but you've been working with his family for a long time and not getting paid, in essence. So these agents don't want to waste that payday for another day more. So whether it's a drafted player who's going to get pulled out by at latest his junior year or these free agents that kind of bud in their freshman or sophomore years of college, they're gone right away. It's the way things are written. The NCAA and the NHL will never seem to find a way to compromise to make it easier to give us a system like the major junior system has with the NHL where teams can sign, they can put them in their camp. If they don't want them, they can send them back to the major junior program. Colleges don't allow that. And without that, we're always going to have these early departures. It got more grotesque after the first lockout there 7-8 years ago now when the collective bargaining agreement changed. But there's nothing that's going to happen. So you're going to have, you know, 30 to 50 players every summer leaving college early, signing. Coaches know about it going in. They actually recruit with that strategy in mind. They're thinking about building a team for players. Some players are going to be there 4 years. Some players are going to be there 3 years. Some players are going to be there 2 years. You know, in the case of a guy like Jack Eichel, it might be 1 year. But coaches know that when they're bringing these players in, when they're recruiting. And I think that it's just become a part of the game. It's something we'll see every single summer for as long as we know the college hockey game.
Some good news today for Bentley University, as there's an announcement they're evaluating sites for a new on-campus arena. They've been playing for many years in the John A. Ryan Skating Arena and really not quite up to what they would desire for Division I. Now plans for a 2,500-seat arena. You've been in the jar many times as I have. This is really terrific, not just for Bentley, but for Atlantic hockey.
Yeah, it's a long time coming. I only live about a mile and a half from Bentley's campus, so I see that campus and what it has become. I had visited there a number of times in college to watch various sports from my college, UMass Lowell, when they go down and play Bentley in volleyball or basketball. So I'd been down there a number of times. Nice campus, was always pretty decent. But they've upgraded it significantly in the recent years, and they've tried to make it more of a university setting, more of a campus that can put a high price tag with that they're asking. I'm pretty sure it's up in the mid-50s to attend there. So they wanted to build something. I wrote a story in 2007 that said the funding was there because at that time I was told by an inside source that the funding was there. The reality was that the funding, I believe, was there and ended up being reallocated. So here we are 8 years later. They're talking about another capital campaign, a 10-year campaign, with a 10-year vision, I should say, for really changing their whole campus yet again. And they do believe that by 2018 they can get into a hockey facility. So it's something they need. For one thing, it's never going to be fair for them to be playing in the John Ryan Arena because it is so far away from the campus. It's, you know, it's a good, I'm going to say 15 minutes away now from their campus with traffic and distance, but it's not even in the town. It's not even in Waltham. It's in Watertown. So, I think that it's a great move for them. I'm very happy for them and what Ryan Soderquist as a coach has been able to do there. And they've had some great success and over the years. They haven't won the big game yet and gotten to an NCAA tournament, but they've had enough success that they're very deserving of this. And it just it puts a better stamp on that entire league with RIT, Canisius, and now Bentley if they become a school with a new arena. I think that would put some pressure on some other schools to continue to move in a positive direction in terms of funding programs and putting money behind programs. I think that that is really what it should be about. Maybe these programs were informed with the belief that they could be financially solvent Division I programs with big arenas or at least modern arenas, but the league in college hockey in general has moved in that direction. It's time for these schools to start keeping up. So big thumbs up to Bentley. I think it's great for them and everything that they've persevered through.
We're going to take a break now. We're going to bring in Niagara head coach Dave Burkholder, who's the coach of one of the teams that both played in a playoff that went to overtime and brought off what would be considered an upset. And he'll join us when we return right here on USCHO Live.
USCHO Live is brought to you by the USCHO Fan Shop at shop.uscho.com. For college hockey and college sports fan gear, visit shop.uscho.com. From U.S. College Hockey Online at uscho.com.
Get ready, Boston. The Frozen Four returns to TD Garden. Be there and experience it live. The top four teams in the country will compete for the title, but only one will make history.
Wow, backhand save!
Become a national champion.
He buries it!
The 2015 NCAA Men's Frozen Four, April 9th and 11th at TD Garden in Boston. Tickets on sale now. Visit ncaa.com/frozen4 and reserve your seats today.
College hockey offers fast-paced action with the unmatched atmosphere of a college campus. Experience the passion and excitement as schools from across the country compete for the NCAA Division I national title. College hockey produces exemplary young men, including one-third of all NHL players, like Ryan Miller, Matt Molson, and Brian Gionta. Whether you're a fan of the game or a prospective player, nothing compares to the college hockey experience. Play it smart. Play college hockey. Visit collegehockeyinc.com.
This is USCHO Live.
Welcome back to USCHO Live. I'm Ed Trefsker along with Jim Connolly.
And we're joined now. We started the show tonight talking about some of the long overtime games, double overtime, triple overtime, five overtime games that were played last weekend. And one of the teams that participated in that, one of those games, was Niagara. And similar to Notre Dame in that five overtime game, Niagara came out on the wrong end of that game, a 2-1 loss to Holy Cross, but still bounced back the following night in won game three of that season of that series to upset Holy Cross. And Dave Burkholder, their head coach, joining us now. Dave, have you recovered from having to go through a weekend of highs and lows like you just did?
Barely. Still a little tired. It just shows the resiliency of our players, because the emotional swings, the momentum changes, and you know, as you mentioned, the Saturday marathon, and for us to persevere through that on the road and win it with a clinching victory Sunday was pretty special. So it's nice to still be talking hockey.
Your team went in, now put things in perspective, a last place team in Atlantic Hockey when the season ended. In the pairwise rankings, you were all the way at the bottom. This was not the regular season that played out. How easy or difficult was it to get your team just to kind of forget all about that and embrace the fact that this was a new season in the postseason?
Yeah, it was almost a relief for everyone involved with our program when the regular season did end. And, you know, as you mentioned, it was a very difficult, trying season for everyone. You know, I think we were preseason pick fourth in the coaches' poll, and we expected to be, you know, to be contesting for a league championship. So to kind of go through what we went through was difficult. And, you know, we had obviously a young team coming in with 17 underclassmen, and then we were hit with the injury bug pretty bad early, and then from there we just were spinning our tires and couldn't just take a hold of the season. So you know, I think the last 3 weeks of the regular season got us on track, and you know, confidence is a fickle thing. I look to the Air Force weekend at home, our second last weekend of the season, and to finally get off the unbeaten streak that we were on. We beat Air Force 6-1 in a great game, and the team kind of just changed after that. We kept saying we got to light the fuse, guys, and I think that was the season changer for us.
Dave, when you're dealing with young players and young minds, and maybe it's egos, maybe it's mentalities, and you use the word confidence, do you sometimes believe as a coach that there is a switch that sometimes can flick, and that is what happened that Air Force weekend? Because you mentioned that win, you got a tie the next night, and then you beat Robert Morris, that has been kind of running away with your conference for most part of the season. There had to be some sort of a switch that flicked in there.
It was, I wish I had an answer for it, but you know, I look back to that weekend, and we did get our two captains back. Kevin Albers is a senior defenseman for us, and he's our shutdown D. He leads us in minutes, and I think he played 35 minutes on Sunday. But we got him back from injury. He had missed, he's missed 12 games this season. And then in the same game, we got our other captain, Matt Denis, who's a junior defenseman, back. And just having the two older guys back there was kind of a calming influence on the team. They're bench bosses. They're positive on the bench. So I think that was a factor. And then, you know, scoring six goals, a couple of guys offensively got out of their slumps and such. And then on Saturday, we were down 4-1 to Air Force at home. And we came back with a huge comeback for a 4-4 tie. And quite frankly, we just ran out of time. I thought if we had a couple more minutes, we would have ended it. But, yeah, that was the weekend that changed over. And the banter around the locker room, being around these guys, is totally, totally different from what we were going through in the regular season.
We're speaking with Dave Burkholder, head coach at Niagara University. Somebody else who seems to have had things really turn on for him in the last five games or so is your starting goaltender, Jackson Tightrope. Just a quick calculation here. It looks like around a 1.5 goals against and a .958 save percentage in the last five games.
Well, he's the story coming out of the Holy Cross series win, and he was up against it. You know, when you're a goalie and you're looking down at the other end in the other crease, and you're looking down at Matt Ginn from Holy Cross, who's an all-league goalie. He's a goalie that I voted for the last 3 years as our best goalie in Atlantic Hockey. So that had to be a tough spot for Jackson. But, you know, when I reflect back on the season, Jackson was under an enormous amount of pressure, you know, playing for a team that was struggling offensively, and he was under the microscope. If he were, you know, when he let in a bad goal, it was magnified. And, you know, I've said, like, there's probably a lot of Division I goalies that let in bad goals that just kind of blend into the game or blend into a season, but that wasn't the case for Jackson. So to see him respond this past weekend, and actually our last little run here that we've been on has been goaltending. That's a big part of it, and it's just nice. Jackson's in the zone, you know, the proverbial zone, but we're going to need him, obviously, going forward if we're going to continue our season.
Dave, when we look at last weekend, and we mentioned a win, a 2-1 win on Friday night, but then that triple overtime game, and you probably felt and tasted the victory in the series at that point. You lose that game, and not only do you have tired players, but now you've probably, you know, mentally damaged by losing a game like that. I've seen players just in teams just kind of collapse when they lose big games like that, but you were able to rally that team. What was said? What had to be said on Sunday morning or Saturday night to get guys back and focused and believing in that they could win the series?
Yeah, we just went in as a staff and were really positive and upbeat, even though it was a devastating loss. And you know, it was after 1:30 a.m. In the morning, so we were more concerned with, you know, getting food into these guys, getting them some nutrition and fuel, so, and getting them to bed. So I will say this, though. Sunday morning, we pushed back breakfast a little later so they could sleep in, and I was really, really concerned about, you know, how we were going to be mentally. And the breakfast was fun. There was spirit. The guys were kibitzing with each other. Like, I thought it was going to be pretty somber. So right at breakfast, I felt we were going to be fine emotionally, and that they didn't let Saturday's overtime loss bother them too much.
Now, that's pretty amazing for young college kids. I think that's a lot more fragile than the NHL, and sometimes those guys lose it after losing games like that. So next on the slate will be league quarterfinals this weekend, and you're going to get to play a team that you just played a few weeks ago, but that you probably have a little bit more of a traditional rivalry within Robert Morris, and the fact that both of you were in College Hockey America, a conference that's now defunct. Is there a little bit of a rivalry between those two teams because of their history?
Absolutely. It's different when we play against Robert Morris, and this is their 11th season of their program, and I believe this is going to be the seventh time in 11 years in their 11-year history that we've met in the playoffs. So we've ended each other's seasons six times so far. So, yeah, and you know what? They're the class of the league. They ran away with it wire to wire this year, and they're coming off the NCAA tournament game last year and winning our playoffs. So it's their league right now. They're high-octane, really fast, you know, one of the best lines in college hockey. So we're up against it, but, you know, we're thrilled to have this opportunity and to hopefully post another upset this weekend.
I think that people who follow Atlantic hockey know a lot about Robert Morris, but those that don't still seem to know the name Cody Wideau for what he has done. Talk a little bit about him as a player, and then more just how he fits into that whole team and being the offensive factor.
Yeah, I think he's the engine that runs that team, you know, as an outsider, as an opposing coach. But just how dynamic he is, and he can stop on a dime, and he's got an absolute rocket for a shot. He can score from anywhere. You know, you throw a pass and it skates, he can still collect it, and it's in the back of the net before he can move. So he's a guy that we're going to have to key on. Not too many teams have had luck shutting him down, but if we can contain that top line, we're certainly going to be in every game, that's for sure.
Well, you did manage to keep Wideau off the scoreboard and just an assist from one of the wingers on that line, so pretty good success in that home-and-home series just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, our senior night Friday, we beat them 2-1 in one of the more exciting games that we've had at Dwyer Arena in a couple of years, and you know, we were hanging on, albeit to hold on for the win, because they were coming at us pretty hard in the third. But again, yeah, if you can stop their power play in that top line, you have a chance.
Hey, we're talking with Dave Burkholder from Niagara. And Dave, take a step away from the playoffs, and news announced today that Bentley is investigating trying to put a new rink onto their campus. And obviously RIT opened a new facility this year. Canisius opened a new facility. What does this say for Atlantic Hockey and kind of the direction that teams seem to be headed in terms of committing financial resources to their programs?
Just phenomenal news, and it's growth. You know, we are trying to get better as a league every year, and I think our play in our non-conference games, I think our record is getting better every year, and we're a league that's producing a lot of professional players, so it's all good. And you know, if Bentley were to get a rink on campus, that's a pretty special school in a hockey hotbed. I mean, they could they could take their program to the next level for sure, and probably start competing with Hockey East for some of those recruits that are still out there in New England.
Dave, after spending the first part of Niagara's career at Division I in the CHA and seeing that just sort of hang on, how's your experience been in Atlantic Hockey? And you mentioned things elevating in the league. How about in general the direction the league is taking?
I love it. It's a great league for us. Obviously, geographically, you know, with our local rivals in, you know, RIT is an hour away. Canisius is cross town, you know, takes us 90 minutes to get to Mercer University. Robert Morris this weekend is going to be a three and a half hour trip for us. So geographically, we've created some great rivalries and added to, you know, the RIT and Canisius, which was already pretty good. So, yeah, we're thrilled. And the league's getting better and you know, to have the names, you know, Air Force and Army and Holy Cross, I think it's a terrific league for Niagara University.
Dave, before we let you go, as we're talking about this kind of directional of a league, what about Niagara Hockey? What would you like to see this program accomplish in its coming years here?
Well, you know, we've had a pretty good run. This is only our 19th season, and, you know, we've had years, multiple years, where we've been nationally ranked, and, you know, we've been to four NCAA tournaments. You know, we test ourselves every year with our non-conference schedule. This past year, we played at Notre Dame in North Dakota. We will continue to do that. We truly believe that we can win a national championship at Niagara. We think we have a great location. Obviously, you know, we have a beautiful campus and a good education, so we have a lot to sell recruits. So, you know, we wake up every day, and that's our goal, is to make our program better, and we aspire to be, you know, one of the big names in college hockey. You know, sometimes we have to sit back and say, hey, it's only been 19 years, but certainly our goal, and we think we can do that at Niagara.
Hey, one thing, you mentioned geographic. Buffalo in general, I was up there for World Juniors and saw that city do well in hosting. We saw a Frozen Four there. Has Buffalo really become mostly a hockey town these days?
It is. It's a pro town. You know, there's no getting around that. I mean, the people love their Buffalo Bills and obviously the Sabres, but you know, we did some math or looked at some numbers, and there were like 150,000 youth hockey players within an hour of our campus. So it's definitely a hockey town, and you know, I think as we get better and we grow the game in our area, the fan base has grown, and certainly what Canisius is doing down the street has certainly helped as well.
Well, Niagara University, the 11th seed of the Atlantic Hockey Tournament, they will go to number one, Robert Morris, this weekend, Friday, Saturday, if necessary, Sunday. Dave Burkholder, we wish you the best of luck this weekend, and if you can get past this, obviously, in the tournament in Rochester. But really, thanks for your time tonight.
I appreciate you having me, guys. Thank you.
That's Dave Burkholder, head coach at Niagara University. They travel to Robert Morris this weekend in the quarterfinal round in Atlantic Hockey. We'll be back with Darren Pritchett, radio voice of Notre Dame, to talk about last weekend, especially that Friday extended overtime when USCHO Live continues.
USCHO Live is brought to you by the USCHO Fan Shop at shop.uscho.com. For college hockey and college sports fan gear, visit shop.uscho.com. USCHO Live from U.S. College Hockey Online at uscho.com.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Did you know that birthday parties help build confidence in kids?
Yeah. Did you know that giving kids less sugar before bedtime helps them sleep better?
Oh, totally. Did you know that friendly kids have more friends?
Everybody knows that.
Hey, guys, did you know that most people think they're using the right car seat for their kid, but they're not?
I didn't know that.
Parents who really know it all know for sure that their child is in the right car seat at the right age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat to make sure your child is protected. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
The Frozen Four returns to Boston.
He buried it!
Be there and experience it live.
Go!
April 9th and 11th at TD Garden in Boston. Tickets on sale now. Visit ncaa.com/frozen4 and reserve your seats today.
This is USCHO Live.
Well, we're back with USCHO Live. And, you know, Jim, I've called a few overtime games in college hockey, and you're always on the edge of your seat, but I have no idea what it's like to do five of them. We're going to find out now as we bring in our next guest.
Yeah, Darren Pritchard, the radio voice of Notre Dame hockey, last Friday night was part of history when he called the longest game in college hockey history. And one thing before I even let you say a thing, Darren, we have to give a tip of the stick because of the fact that you did this game by yourself. You don't have a color analyst, which I could not imagine as a radio guy doing a game this long by myself. So hats off for that. But what was it like to be able to be involved in a game like that?
First, guys, great to be with you. Thank you so much for having me on your show. And I remember the second overtime, we're a couple of minutes in, I just made the comment, if we're going to be here a while, we might as well just go ahead and break the record. And honestly, I knew it was a five overtime game, and I didn't know the exact minutes. But as the game went a little further, we started getting updates for the 25th longest, the 18th longest. So I got to be honest, even though I didn't have an analyst with me, and I never do, the adrenaline of playoff hockey kept you going. And I was great the whole night. Now, I will admit, in the fifth overtime, my eyes actually started burning a little bit, which is nothing compared to what the players went through. But it was just something special to be a part of. But I will say this, when that adrenaline fatigue set in the next morning, I felt like I'd been run over by a truck. It was something that I'd never really felt before.
Go ahead. I was going to say, on that point, you talk about adrenaline. It's not just the length of it. It's that once you get into overtime, every play becomes the play that could end the game. So you're on the edge of your seat or on the tips of your toes that whole time. What was it like to go through four and a half periods with that level of intensity?
You know, like I said, the adrenaline kept you going, and I did. Overtimes two through five just are sort of blended together. I can't pick out certain moments in like overtimes two, three, and four. I remember a few things in five. We had a chance to win it. Mario Lutia, one of the top goal scorers in the country, was ready to rip a one-timer from the right circle, and his stick just shattered in two as he put his stick on the ice. And I thought that was going to be it, but you're exactly right, guys. Every time down the ice, you think that could be the moment. And there's a part of you that's a broadcaster but also a fan. When you travel with these young men, you get to know them, you're cheering for them, trying not to be too much of a homer. But it was just almost surreal. It got to the point where you're almost laughing like, I don't know if this is really ever going to end. I did mention during the broadcast, as a youngster when I was just learning about hockey, I stayed up for the 1987 Islanders, Capitals, four overtimes, Stanley Cup playoff game. Pat LaFontaine won it. And I just remember then as a kid, like, wow, how cool would it be a part of something like that? Now, I had no chance to be a hockey player. So as a broadcaster, that was my only chance to be a part of something like this. And it is special to be a part of something that people are going to remember for a long time, even though the Irish lost the game.
Well, and that was the next point I really wanted to get to, Darren. What impresses me the most when we talk about the players on the ice was Notre Dame's ability to rebound from that. You know, I was sitting on Twitter with about 100 people on Twitter talking about that game and going back and forth, and everybody kept saying, and I don't know if I agreed with them at the time, but I understood where they were coming from. Boy, whoever wins this game is going to win the series guaranteed. Notre Dame came back. They win the next two games, a tight one on Saturday night, very convincing win on Sunday night.
Mm-hmm.
Did you still have a pretty good belief in that team that they still could win that series?
Well, I made the same comment during one of the overtimes. I can't tell you which one, that this is one of those games, since it's such a short series, three-game series, the loser is going to have a very difficult time winning this particular three-game matchup. So there was a part of me after that game wondered, how would Notre Dame handle it mentally, let alone physically, just being put on the ledge? If they lose the next game, their season is over. How would they respond? And, guys, I got to be honest, you can talk about X's and O's. You can talk about execution on the ice. And Notre Dame did those things in games two and three. But to me, I go back to August when this team was together getting ready for school. And Tony Rolinski is our strength and conditioning coach at Notre Dame. He does basketball and hockey. And what he got these guys doing at that time, I think, won this series. Game three was all about fitness. And I just think Notre Dame, to me, was in a little better physical shape than Massachusetts. So I go back to August, all that strength and conditioning work from then up until the moment before game three, I think that was a huge difference in the game.
And maybe we're talking with Darren Pritchett, the radio voice of Notre Dame. Maybe that was part of the fact that Jeff Jackson was able to come back with the exact same lineup the next night. I expected that it was almost inevitable, no matter what as a coach you wanted to do, that you'd have to change out as many players as you possibly could just to get that extra depth in your lineup. Jeff Jackson didn't do that. He bounced back with the same lineup, saying, I believe in you guys. I believe in the physical condition that you're in.
You know, I was wondering the same thing going to the arena. I just received the line charts, and I was actually a little surprised. I'm not a hockey genius. I'm just a novice calling the games. But there was a part of me that said, I thought a couple of guys would be switched out just to get some fresh legs, but you're exactly right. Coach believed in the process after the game. They had them doing some fitness work already, trying to get them ready for game number two. I know they were on a strict fluids and food. They were getting themselves in the best position to succeed later that night. And it worked perfectly. They really looked strong. I was actually surprised, guys, how strong we looked in game two. I really wasn't sure what to expect. But they executed at a high level in game two, even though it was tied going into the third period. I think the difference in the two teams, maybe the fitness started to take over in the third period of game two. The Irish came off that third period break and just started storming and got those three quick goals to really set the tone for the rest of that game. And like I said, once the third game got going and a fluky goal started the game 48 seconds in, you really got the feeling that Notre Dame would be able to come all the way back after losing that five overtime game.
Well, with that series win, Notre Dame now will travel to UMass Lowell, a team that Notre Dame hasn't seen since really early November, quite some time ago in the season. I was out there in South Bend for that series, and I then saw Notre Dame play at BU a couple of weeks ago. It does seem that Notre Dame is a very, very different team than what that team that faced Lowell back in November.
Yeah, they've come a long way, and a couple of things stand out. First off, when we were struggling in the first half and early in the second half, the goaltending was very inconsistent. We were going between sophomore Chad Katnar and freshman Cal Peterson. There'd be a couple of moments where it looked like Cal was going to be the number one. Then there'd be one of those games where you wondered, well, maybe it's going to be Chad. So they went back and forth. But once we were up at Maine and Katnar started the first game of that series in early February, and we were tied going to the third, Jeff went to Cal, and ever since then, he has been as consistent of a goaltender as you can find in college hockey. The .962 save percentage in February and faced all those shots against Massachusetts. So, number one, goaltending has improved, and probably Cal has stolen a couple of games when the Irish were playing those top 10 teams back-to-back-to-back, Providence, BU, and Boston College. And number two, the first half, the power play, it was a struggle. They just had no chemistry. They hit posts. We were last for, I think, a couple of weeks on the power play. But January 10th, that day forward, we've really had more success. I think we've had 16 or 17 power play goals since January 10th. So just getting a power play goal every once in a while has helped this team. And when you have so many freshmen playing, specifically on the blue line, it's just taken them some time to get comfortable. And something we work on, and I know Coach Jackson is stressing, is that pass from your defensive zone out to center ice to get transition going. That's something we're very inconsistent with, and if we can ever get better in that area, I think we would see a little more offense from this team.
Darren, talking about the power play, is something that the improvement of the power play, is that maybe it's just some of the guys that you expect to score finally scoring, or is it more? Is there a little bit more to it than that? Because it did seem that there were some guys like Hinostroza and Lucia in here that were just snake bit at the beginning of the season.
Boy, a couple of things come to mind. First, you lose a lot of really good offensive players from last year's team, like a Brian Rust, for example. Then we had a really strange few weeks, and maybe it's even a little longer than that, guys, where for some reason guys were shooting the puck, and we were passing too much and waiting for that perfect tic-tac-toe type goal, and it wasn't happening. And I think also there was a little chemistry that wasn't there yet. We weren't winning puck battles along the board. And I think once the coaching staff moved the pieces around a little bit and got their players in better positions to succeed, the power play really started clicking. But the ability of Robbie Russo to be a threat at the point has caused teams to come out and defend him, and I think that's opened up some players down low. So once Robbie started getting pucks on net and he started scoring, all of a sudden that opened up other things. And I think Hinostroza now being more of a scorer than just a playmaker has really helped the power play. And when you have a guy like Lucia, you get the puck on his stick in a goal-scoring area, you like your chances in that situation.
We're speaking with Darren Pritchett, play-by-play radio broadcaster for Notre Dame. One last thing before we let you go. You were around for the tail end of the CCHA era and now into Hockey East. Can you compare and contrast a little bit on the change from what was more of a bus league to now a flight league?
Yeah, the travel is definitely different. We went from those 12, 13-hour bus rides, take on Northern Michigan and Lake Superior State, to now we charter wherever we go in Hockey East, which is a tremendous advantage. I know there have been several Hockey East teams coming to us during this brutal winter that have had to stay several days in Chicago, and I definitely feel for them. So the travel is different. Actually, we get home sooner being in Hockey East than many of the trips in the CCHA just because of being able to charter. So that's a big difference. It's taken us a little while to adjust. The depth of Hockey East is tremendous. I thought the goaltending last year, guys, in Hockey East, and you're more familiar with the conference through the years than me, but there was a great goaltender, I feel like, every night in Hockey East last year. And I think that was the biggest change for me from the CCHA. I'm not saying there was bad goaltending in the conference, but I just thought from top to bottom, Hockey East was full of great goaltenders. There's a lot of good goaltenders again this year. So that's been an adjustment. And just the speed of Hockey East has probably been an adjustment for the guys specifically last year compared to what we have in the CCHA. We're a little quicker team this year compared to the last few years as we trend more toward being a skating team. But when you go on the road in Hockey East, most of those buildings are rocking. It's great environments. Some of the schools in the CCHA, there just wasn't that environment anymore, like Northern Michigan, Lake Superior State, Bowling Green, although I'm sure that place is rocking a little more now with Bowling Green being a top 15 team once again. But the environments are incredible. I'd say it's been an adjustment with some of the officiating from time to time, but the speed of the goaltending in Hockey East is just remarkable. There is just not a night off in this conference.
Well, Darren Pritchett, I believe by the time you get to Lowell later this week, your voice hopefully will be fully rested and recovered, and you'll not have another 10 or 12 or 14 periods of hockey to call this weekend, that it can be a quicker series, as I'll be on the other end of the Lowell radio, so I don't really want to go through one of those 5-0 games. I don't think my heart could take that one, but we do look forward to seeing you out in Lowell this weekend, and we really appreciate you taking the time to recount what really was a special night for college hockey.
Well, guys, thanks for what you do for college hockey. We need more people like you supporting this great sport, and it just keeps getting better and better. Look at the talent in this league. It's unbelievable, and look forward to heading up to Lowell, my second chance to go to the Songa Center, so we will see you there, and hopefully we'll have a very entertaining.
That's Darren Pritchett, Notre Dame Radio, and we'll be back to wrap up this week's edition of USCHO Live right after this.
USCHO Live is brought to you by the USCHO Fan Shop at shop.uscho.com. For college hockey and college sports fan gear, visit shop.uscho.com. USCHO Live from U.S. College.
Get ready, Boston. The Frozen Four returns to TD Garden.
Score!
Be there and experience it live. The top four teams in the country will compete for the title, but only one will make history.
Wow! Backhand save!
Become a national champion.
He buries it!
The 2015 NCAA Men's Frozen Four, April 9th and 11th at TD Garden in Boston. Tickets on sale now. Visit ncaa.com/frozen4 and reserve your seats today.
This is USCHO Live.
And welcome back to USCHO Live. I'm Ed Trefsker along with Jim Connolly. Five out of six conferences enter into playoffs this weekend. It's quarterfinal rounds in all of them that are underway. We talked a little bit about Atlantic Hockey with Dave Burkholder just quickly in that league. Niagara split a series home and home with Robert Morris near the end of the season. There's going to be some upset in this round. To have number 11 upset number one may be a stretch, but it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Just the fact that they took them, to both, a one goal game in each game they played just a few weeks ago. That I believe what Dave Burkholder said. They have a lot of believability in this team. Just the fact that they were able to come back from a triple overtime loss and have these players come and win a game the next day, that really impressed me.
The other couple of matchups I've got my eye on: Mercyhurst at Bentley. That's going to be a great series. Air Force coming into RIT. There was no game at RIT between those two schools this year. They've been rivals since they joined the league. I expect that to be a great series.
Yeah, it certainly should be one. I think RIT seems to be playing some of their better hockey down the stretch, so I would kind of put the advantage in. I think any time you can play a game on that campus, there's a major advantage. So I wouldn't be surprised to see RIT be able to come out on top there.
It's interesting, in the Rick Bennett era, as we turn to ECAC, Union has not lost in the playoffs, if I'm not mistaken. And they downed Cornell last weekend, and after a really down year after a national championship, they head into Quinnipiac. Harvard and Yale, the other really big matchup in the ECAC.
Yeah, convincing fashion for Union. And, I think that Cornell really lost things down the stretch of their season. In Union, they're playing some of their better hockey. They had some really doldrum days in the middle of their season. So I do think that Quinnipiac is in for a tough test. These guys have played some incredible games against one another in the past, including a regional final a couple of years ago. So I think there will be a lot of hunger on both sides in that one. And the Harvard-Yale, I got to see Harvard play on Saturday night, covered that game, and thought that they are skating better than they were in the January-February time frame. They got some good bounces, they got some good goaltending, and they were able to close out a pretty hungry Brown team that played very, very, very good hockey. I think they had just maybe one loss in seven games heading into the playoffs. So I think that Yale has their hands full with Harvard. Harvard is playing more like the team that was number one and number two, number three in the country in the poll there in late December than the team that was falling off the edge of the cliff here. Really in early February, early to mid-February. So I think that Harvard has kind of righted the ship. They've gotten some guys back, including Colin Blackwell, who missed all of last season and most of this season. He's back in the lineup. He scored three goals last weekend. So I think that that is a series where Yale really has to be ready. There's something they really are going to have to worry about.
In Hockey East, Vermont is coming off what was a thrilling three-game series with Maine ending in overtime on Sunday. They come in to take on Boston College.
And maybe not the greatest matchup for Vermont, especially to head on the road, but I saw them the final weekend of the regular season. I thought they were playing some excellent hockey. They do depend on their goaltender a lot. Mike Santaguida has been phenomenal of late. He can make a lot of saves. He's similar to a guy like Cal Peterson at Notre Dame that we just heard Darren talking about. I don't really have a good feel for where that series is going to go. Boston College played great down the stretch. I thought they were one of the better teams in the second half of the season. And if anybody that knows Jerry York knows that that's usually the case. So we'll be interested to see where that series goes. I know that Vermont has the capability of winning that series. Whether they can go on the road and execute, though, that's a totally different story.
Merrimack has a pair at BU, or a best of three at BU. Can the Warriors clamp down the Terriers?
Yeah, you know, this reminds me of, I think it was 1998 or 1999, when Ron Anderson, his last year of coaching at Merrimack, was a lame duck coach and went in there and beat Jack Parker's Boston University squad, who was number one in the country back then. This is a little different, where it's David Quinn, it's Mark Dennehy. The coaches have changed. Maybe the arena has changed, but this would be as big of an upset if Merrimack were to go into BU and pull off this series. They do it with goaltending and defense. They give up a lot of shots, but they try to hold you to the perimeter. They have some abilities to shut down offenses, but you got to stop Jack Eichel and that whole Jack Eichel line. And you got to be aware of some of the defensemen, Matt Grizzly coming in, for the point that there's a lot of challenges that really lie ahead for Merrimack. I would say that BU should be able to come out of that series.
Well, how about New Hampshire? 7 wins in a row as they head to Providence.
Yeah, that's a tough series there for Providence. I think that Providence thought that they had maybe avoided having to play New Hampshire just the way the seedings were lining up, and then you get an upset here, and that next thing you know, you're taking on this New Hampshire team that just really dominated UConn last weekend. I think the shots at one point on Saturday night were 30-9 in the third period. They played great defense. They generated the offense. So dangerous, really dangerous team. I think John Gillies is going to have to be the difference maker in that series. Holm Ice has been really friendly to Providence this year as well, so that could be play another big role.
In the NCHC, it would not surprise me to see some upsets. One great matchup, of course, is two ranked teams, Minnesota Duluth at Denver. But, you know, Western Michigan, even with a down year, Miami playing great this year. Is there a room for one there? St. Cloud State, can they take it from Omaha? It may be a stretch for CC in North Dakota, but still, a very competitive league. I would not be surprised to see one or two upsets out of that.
Yeah, I would not be surprised to see 3 of those 4 bottom seeds advance. I think that the 2, 3, and 4 teams in that league are all vulnerable. I don't think North Dakota has too much to worry about, but Colorado College did play decent hockey down the stretch. I still think that North Dakota, and they're in a position I feel like they could just run over this entire tournament. It may be part of the NCAA field the way that they're playing right now. So, you know the playoffs, that, you know, goaltending and steal it. I don't believe that Colorado College has good goaltending, but every other single one of those teams you mentioned has a good goaltender. I think that that is the playoffs where we're going to see the most upsets this weekend.
WCHA, pretty good teams there. Minnesota State, Michigan Tech hosting series. They've got Minnesota State has Lake Superior, Huntsville, Alabama Huntsville making its first WCHA playoffs. Have to travel up to Houghton to take on Michigan Tech, and Bowling Green hosting Northern Michigan. The other one, Bemidji hosting Ferris State. This league, I think upsets are less likely.
Yeah, the Bemidji-Ferris State series, I think, is an interesting one, because I think that Ferris State is a better team than they've played at many times this season. Maybe this league doesn't line up for the upsets. I don't think that Alabama-Huntsville has too much of a shot. I don't see a ton of upsets in this league. I think you've got the top half of that league was extremely good this year. The bottom half was average. And, you know, I know that you've eliminated a couple of teams. I guess it's both Alaska teams, one through probation and the other one through actually missing by finishing in last place. But, I just don't see too much. I agree with you. I don't see too much in terms of upsets in that league.
And it's the final weekend of the regular season for the Big Ten. Home and home, Michigan and Michigan State. The Spartans are in first place. Penn State's at Minnesota. The Gophers really, they're hanging on to the bubble in the pairwise. It's a huge implications for them for the postseason. and Ohio State at Wisconsin to see if maybe the Badgers can pull out something at the end of the season to kind of turn the corner a little bit heading into playoffs.
Yeah, that Michigan-Michigan State series promises to be a great one. Not only are they great rivals, but, you know, they've played three times already this season. I believe Michigan's won twice. They've all been on neutral ice. None of the games have been played at either of the team's stadiums. They'll play a home-and-home this weekend, which I think is nice. The fact that you can close out with a home-and-home in that league, with given some of the space, travel space between those teams. But Michigan State, here they are on the, you know, here we are on the final weekend of the regular season. They control their destiny. They sweep Michigan. They're the Big Ten champions. I don't think anybody saw this coming even 2 months ago. That, you know, I think that Michigan State has been the only team in that league that has found success through defense. And I still say when it comes down to the postseason, defense and special teams wins championships. And if you've got that defense first, then you can do a lot. We talked about it off the top of the show, how often some of these teams have just been able to kind of throw three guys across a red line and play a 1-3-1 the entire game. Michigan State does that in spades. They do it very well. So I look forward to kind of watching from afar that entire Big Ten play out this weekend. Know that a few of those games, I believe, are on TV, so that should be a lot of fun for fans to watch.
Jim, before we go, we do want to thank our sponsor, the NCAA Men's Frozen Four. Excuse me, don't get left out in the cold this spring. Be there as the best of the best will compete for the title of national champion. Experience the NCAA Men's Frozen Four. Regional action drops the puck March 27th through 29 and continues April 9 and 11 at the Frozen Four in Boston. Experience it live as determination will make history. Visit ncaa.com/frozen4 to make a date with champions. And Jim, before we go, just a word to the listeners. As soon as the final game is done this weekend, whether it's Saturday or most likely Sunday night, the USCHO pairwise predictor will be up and running. We have some new features added to it this year that we're pretty excited about. We hope you'll check it out and see what all the different permutations might prove out to be for the postseason when that goes live on Sunday night.
Which that translates to, don't bother with your day job next week. You're going to be running the pairwise scenarios somewhere around 100,000 times, and you might lose your job. So be very careful with job security is what I guess I'm saying.
Yeah, and we're going to be tracking every single permutation that people try so that we can see what people are guessing and what people are coming up with for results. So that should be a lot of fun. So, Jim, we'll talk to you next Tuesday night for USCHO Live. And I hope to have all of you who are listening tune in then as well.
Look forward to it, Ed.
All right. Take care, Jim. And this has been USCHO Live.